Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the uncertain future of Arizona's new state immigration law, and we dive into the mystical genre of beach noir. But first, 2 years ago, after several attempts, an initiative exposing who is behind the dark money in our politics finally made it to the ballot. Voters passed it overwhelmingly. It's been challenged a few times since, and just this week, the Arizona Court of Appeals upheld it again, saying it serves an important government interest in curbing corruption and ensuring voters know who is trying to sway elections. This was the first election that law has been in place. So we're going to take the next few minutes here to talk about what kind of difference it made. And to explain it to us, here is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke with our politics desk. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so you are the kind of reporter who digs into spending and dark money in politics, looks at who's spending and what on what campaigns. How did this law work for you?
Well, not well. the show had Barry Joe Pitzel from The Republic on a few months ago to talk about how some of the information that was supposed to be up wasn't even there. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing a lot of reports filed, but it's filed on a site that I find most comparable to, like, the local government races I used to cover in cities, which is to say it's a list of PDFs that you just kind of have to click on and go through each one individually. It's not sortable. It's not searchable. The PDFs are searchable, but it's not – you can't sort by different organizations and see how much they spent over time. You have to click on each individual report. Mm. So needless to say, it's just really difficult to get through to find any useful information at all, if it's even there.
Okay, so if it's there, and then when you look at those PDFs, what do they say? Like, who's disclosing what?
So a lot of these are actually PACs that are filing these, which are actually required to do disclosures anyway before the dark money law, but some of them are getting money from these 501c4, these nonprofit dark money groups. And as the law is written, what it's supposed to do is basically these dark money groups are supposed to disclose any donor who gave $5,000 or more for these large campaigns, as long as the overall campaign had spent over $50,000. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing, at least, and I haven't gotten through every one of these PDFs, but I've tried to look at the big ones, is we're not really getting that level of drilling down to that level of clarity. There's a PAC called CHSPA, which was started by the League of Conservation Voters. CHSPA is a PAC, has to disclose all this money anyway, but League of Conservation Voters is a dark money group. And they disclose that they got, you know, around $3.5 million from League of Conservation Voters, but it doesn't go beyond that. They're just saying it came directly from this group. We're not getting that further detail on, like, who gave the money to the League of Conservation Voters that then passed through to this PAC.
Okay, so while this may be well-intentioned, it sounds like, in the big picture at least, just the way these disclosures are posted and the layers and layers and layers of donors gets a little bit convoluted.
Yeah, and so when you don't have that searchable, sortable database, it becomes difficult to drill down and find out which organizations are doing this, how they're intended, which ones aren't. If they aren't, what's their reasoning for it? Is it a defensible reason? So all of those are questions we're still trying to ask, trying to find answers to right now.
Yeah. What did dark money look like in this year's election, Wayne? Like, especially in some of these local races that you follow really closely, like, were there races where dark money could have made a big impact?
Yeah. I mean, so there wasn't as much dark money, honestly, as I expected in the traditional sense that we think kind of funneled through these C4 groups. As I mentioned, League of Conservation Voters via CHSPA spent quite a bit of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, on Democrats running for the Corporation Commission. That did not work out well for them. They didn't win a single seat of the three that were up. Mm. Also, Americans for Prosperity, one of kind of the very famous Koch network dark money groups, spent tens of thousands of dollars on GOP candidates at the legislature. That worked out better for them. They did win a lot of those races. But again, Americans for Prosperity didn't actually file anything in the dark money portal. And I noticed that in the traditional portal, when they're doing their expenses, everything, all the races they spent on, they say that this was paid for with investment income. Hmm. And I'm thinking that's a way to circumvent it, because they're saying this didn't come from donors. This came from our own investments that we're paying. So it's Americans for Prosperity, this big, you know, kind of faceless group.
Interesting. So even though money is sort of through the roof in politics today, there's more money being spent on even these local races than we've almost ever seen before. It seems like it's reached a tipping point in which it's so much money, it doesn't even matter all the time.
Yeah. And so, like I mentioned, like, in the Corporation Commission race, we saw, you know, so much money spent on the Democratic side, and they didn't end up winning a single seat. So there's, like you said, there's just so much money involved in this, some coming from individuals, some coming from these dark money groups, and a lot coming from just corporations, that I think both sides have so much money to spend that almost you're washing each other out.
Given the amount of money in politics today, this is like post-Citizens United, right, which changed everything in this realm. Do you think it's almost impossible to make this kind of dark money and whatever dark money might mean to folks transparent to voters? Like, the idea here is that voters will understand who's trying to sway their votes in these elections.
I don't think it's – I don't necessarily say impossible. It might be impossible to drill down to the level of detail that maybe this the act intended. But, I mean, we are still seeing – like a lot of organizations disclosed where this money is coming from, and not just these faceless dark money groups. Mm-hmm. You know, I looked at the House Victory PAC, which is was fighting for Republicans running for the House of Representatives, and they did have, you know, disclosed that a lot of businesses like Chevron, Sports Betting Industry Association, Dairy Industry Association were giving money to them, which, again, because they're a PAC, was required before this went into effect. So you might not know the exact name of the individual, but you can still see the organizations, the type of people that are giving to these causes.
Wayne, what could make this anti-dark money law that voters passed here and that voters clearly wanted here more useful, and not just to journalists like you, but to the public itself, right, to that purpose?
Well, I think, and this goes for the general kind of campaign contribution side as well, just making it more user-friendly. I mean, the campaign contribution site we have is better than the dark money site in that you can search individual groups, see how much they spent over time, sort expenses and who's given them the money and all that stuff, but it's still a little bit wonky, a little bit outdated. And then, as I mentioned, the dark money site is light years behind that. So I think, but that all takes money. The Secretary of State's office has said as much. Like, if you want these sites improved, we need the money to do it. They've got a little bit of money from Clean Elections to start that, but there's just not the money there yet to kind of bring these sites into the, you know, into the 2020s, even the 2010s at this point.
All right, we will leave it there for now. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Yeah, thank you.
Arizona voters overwhelmingly passed Prop 314 on Election Day last week. The initiative was referred to the ballot by the legislature last session after Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a similar bill. It was dubbed the Secure the Border Act, but it goes beyond the border itself. The proposition will make it a state crime for anyone to cross into the state between ports of entry, as well as make it harder for non-citizens to get public benefits and impose stiff sentences for selling fentanyl that causes someone to death. What's often been called the new SB 1070 didn't face much public opposition, even from some immigrant rights advocates who rallied loudly against 1070 more than a decade ago. And when voters decided on it at the polls last week, they passed it with more than 60% support. But the law won't go into effect anytime soon, if at all. And our next guest is here to explain why. Jeremy Duda is a reporter for Axios Phoenix, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning.
Okay, so Prop 314 was modeled after a Texas law that got a lot of attention last year, SB 4. And a key piece of this law is actually even tied to it, right?
Yes, it was modeled off it, and the legislation, the language of the law, very specifically ties them together and does not allow the Arizona provision to go into effect unless, you know, the Texas provision goes into effect or a similar law in another state. It has to be in effect for 60 continuous days, and that is this provision that makes it a state crime to cross the border illegally, a state crime to cross into Arizona from Mexico anywhere except for an official port of entry. And that is, there's a couple of other provisions regarding fentanyl, illegal fentanyl sales that lead to, you know, overdose deaths, to public benefits, but this unauthorized entry, this illegal entry provision is really the heart of the law.
Right, and what most people would associate with it, right? So if SB 4 in Texas doesn't make it through the courts, this kind of major portion of this law goes out the window?
Or at least goes on hold. You know, it's possible another state could pass something similar and that could go through. A lot depends on the courts. Right now, the Texas law has been stayed. It's on hold. They heard arguments in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals back in April, and a ruling on that could come any time. Suppose, you know, theoretically that the Fifth Circuit strikes it down, but another state that's covered by a different circuit court of appeals passes it, and that allows it to go into effect. Then it could. There's just so many different moving parts from the legal system. Right now, we could get a ruling from the Fifth Circuit pretty much any day, from my understanding from folks involved in the Texas case. If, you know, that could mean the law could go into effect in 60 days from now, you know, the Arizona provision goes into effect as well, or right. It could be stayed while they appeal to the Supreme Court and could eventually go into effect in a couple of years from now, or could never. Kind of depends on what the Fifth Circuit does and then what the Supreme Court does, because presumably whoever loses the Texas case will still appeal that.
Right. So we should expect whoever wins the Fifth Circuit Court to appeal to the Supreme Court. This will likely end up at the Supreme Court, it seems. And this, as you said there quickly, could take a long time.
That it could. Now, there are a couple of other laws that some folks feel like could be similar enough to trigger that illegal entry provision in Prop 314. There's one in Oklahoma and one in Iowa, but they're still kind of inspired by similar concepts, but very different. Of course, Arizona and Texas are unique in that we are two of the only four states that have a border with share a border with Mexico. I suppose someone on the Canadian, a state on the Canadian border could pass a similar law, and you know that might be it may be enough.
Sure.
If, you know, the Iowa law makes it a crime to come into the state if you've been deported or denied entry to the U.S. Oklahoma law does that, plus also makes it a state crime to come into the state if you are not authorized to be in the United States at all. And I think that one, you could go into court and potentially make an argument that they're similar enough, but it still lacks that border provision. So if, you know, that happened, I presume, you know, one side or the other would sue out here in Arizona to say, yes, that's good, close enough, we should enforce the law, or hey, that's not close enough, we've got to put it on hold.
Interesting. Okay, so it's tied to the Texas law, but there are some other laws that may be similar enough. The courts will decide all of that. So I wonder, Jeremy, like, was all of this symbolic? Like, the other aspects of this proposition will go into effect, I assume.
Yeah, the other ones were the public benefits, which was kind of where this all started in the first place, with House Speaker Toma trying to pass the public benefits provision, which Governor Hobbs vetoed, and then the fentanyl provision. And so those will, but as I mentioned, you know, the heart of the law really is the illegal entry one. And that's really, I think, what most folks were probably looking at when they voted for this.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to take it one step further here before we let you go. At the same time as this is all playing out in the courts and could be for some time, we have heard law enforcement officials around the state kind of question this measure and if they have the resources to carry it out. Even those who may be in support of it say they might not have the resources to carry it out. Could there be, it sounds like, other hurdles, Jeremy, to enforcing this measure, even if it does go into effect?
Oh, certainly, because, you know, we were talking, you know, in some cases, you know, small, you know, border town police forces, or, you know, border area, you know, county sheriff's departments who, you know, again, you know, I mean, if limited resources, they have only so many things they could do. And if you have to turn that much attention, that much of your manpower to enforcing this border provision, that, you know, does not potentially leave you a lot of resources to do other stuff, depending. And, you know, the legislature did not provide any funding to law enforcement agencies for this, which I know a lot of them are not super pleased about. I guess we'll see. We'll see if that changes, you know, this session or this upcoming legislative session, or if and when this actually goes into effect. I guess there's no, unless the Fifth Circuit gives it the okay and the stay is lifted in Texas, then I guess, you know, people can wait and can take a wait and see approach and, you know, see if any money is actually needed to enforce this.
Yeah. All right. Wait and see on a lot of levels there. Jeremy Duda with Axios Phoenix joining us. Jeremy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what is surf noir? An author shares his fascination with the literary genre that lies at the intersection of gritty crime stories and the beach. But next up on the show, let's turn to our week-long series on our country's new multi-generational workforce and an author who has worked just about every job you can think of in her not that long career. Lydia Parr entered the workforce young, at age 14 to be exact. That might sound like child labor, but to her, it offered freedom and a way to make a little money. Her first job? As a sandwich artist at Subway, and it was on from there. She documents it all in her new book, The Entrance is the Exit, Essays on Escape. But she told me what started out as a book about all of the weird jobs she's had turned into something deeper that explored class, labor, and mobility. I spoke with her more about it, beginning with how she felt about starting in the workforce at such a young age.
To me, it was a good thing in terms of learning about the working world kind of right away, getting into it early. So Subway, the sandwich artist, was the first job.
Yeah.
And then from there, went to Blockbuster. And then from there, a place called Country Bill's Steakhouse. And those were all in high school. I did have a job at the mall that I did not write about because that only lasted a month.
Yeah.
And then it was trying to join the military to pay for college. I was planning to be an Army reservist. And then from there, it's been, you know, bartender, hostel worker, like front desk worker. I worked training an AI bot for several years, which was one of the more recent jobs. And then teaching adjunct faculty. And so there's a landscaper, cook, prep cook. There's been a lot.
It's a list. Okay, so we have to talk about Subway a little bit more because this is the first chapter of the book. You title it Escape Artist, which sort of plays on the sandwich artist thing. And I want to get to that idea of escape in a moment. But tell us first about the issues that come up right away. Like this book seems to be about dealing with class in the workforce right away because, you know, you're 14 and you talk about friends from wealthier families coming, thinking it's fun that you work there. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
So I went to a Catholic high school. I was on scholarship and my mom worked really hard to pay for it. Being a recently divorced mom, Lynn, living in, you know, our grandma's kind of attic area. So for me, it was like, okay, this is maybe going to be my ticket out to something, you know? And I had a lot of friends from that Catholic school, didn't have to work. They didn't have jobs. So they had a lot more free time. It was fun for them to come in and sort of, you know, ask me for free sandwiches. It was fun. Mm. It was amusing. They would try to have jalapeno pepper eating contests. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm kind of on the floor. I'm expected to be cleaning and helping customers and wiping things down and prepping stuff in the back. And so it was maybe a first moment of, oh, there are different things that different people have to do.
Yeah.
It's not all the same.
So as you outlined there, like you have worked jobs on all sides of the spectrum, but it sounds like there have been common themes throughout many of those experiences, whether you're in the service industry working at Subway or Blockbuster when you're 14 or 15, or whether you're working in, you know, customer service or for, you know, the job you mentioned about training an AI bot.
Yeah. And granted, I have not worked all of the different kinds of jobs there are to work in the world. Most of them have been in some way sort of customer service based or customer service adjacent. But something I think about a lot lately is like how people in these roles are treated, how you're expected to be on and available and perfect, almost like a robot yourself for people who are expecting some kind of a service from you. And I think that's a through line from, you know, working at a very public facing job like Blockbuster, Subway, or a restaurant, or training the bot where I was sort of veiled behind the artificial intelligence that was between me and the customers that were part of the, you know, the training process. Mm-hmm. And even as a teacher, there's a certain level of expectation around the kind of service that you're supposed to provide. And I think that what I'm hoping that people start to think about more is the humanness of the people who are doing these jobs.
There's almost a level of violence as a theme throughout this too, like not abuse in like a child labor abuse kind of way, but the lack of humanity.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because I feel like I learned kind of early on in some of those very public facing customer service roles that a lot of people, a lot of my coworkers would resort to drug addiction or drinking. Not to say that any of that in and of itself is, I don't have a moral judgment about that, but I think that a lot of behaviors were maybe sort of used as remedies for the stresses of the workplace, mm-hmm. Finding some kind of escape. This is something that Barbara Ehrenreich also talked about in Nickel and Dime some years ago. She wrote that book over a decade ago.
This book really reminded me of that, yes.
And it starts to, the role that you play at work and the way that work works, it really does start to impact your personal relationships, your self-esteem, your conception of yourself, your idea about your own mobility in the working world, how much you actually have the capacity to change your life. And some of that has to do with how much you're getting paid. A lot of that has to do with how much you're getting paid too. But I feel like when you're in a role as a worker and you don't have a lot of choice and you don't have a lot of mobility, there is an inescapability from certain kinds of violence. You know, whether it's abusiveness from a customer or whether it's coping mechanisms or whether it's a loss of faith or hope in your own ability to make change. I do think that there are many different kinds of violence that are worth talking about with relationship to the kind of work you do and the kind of class that you find yourself in at any point in time.
Hmm. So, right, that inescapability that you just mentioned there, I wanted to ask you about this because the subtitle of the book is Essays on Escape. And as we mentioned, the first chapter is called An Escape Artist, which is a reference to, you know, the sandwich artist job. But what are you getting at there? Like, what are we escaping or what are you escaping in these essays?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I'm escaping a lot of things in the essays. And I think that part of it has to do with, you know, job stuff and financial stuff. So class, economics, things like that. And part of that, which is connected, would be like bad relationships or friendships that aren't quite maybe as positive as we think, or even ideologies, worldviews, ways of moving through the world, you know, bad habits. I think that the essay started out as a framework around jobs, like that was the skeleton, that was kind of the artifice behind it. Like I could frame a lot of things around jobs that I've had. And then it kind of went out to these other places where it was like, what kinds of things am I trying to get to a better place with on the whole? But I'm attempting to end with a hopeful message because I am an optimistic person. Like you do have the power, I think. We do have the power to make ourselves better people, better collaborators, better interactors, better to each other. So there are better places to escape to, like to form the realities that we actually want to live. But it ends up being kind of a prevailing question, overarching question, like how malleable are our positions? How much personal work do we have to do in order to be conscious of what we're trying to get out of, systems that we're trying to get out of? And how do we have a different vision if we're doing this completely by imagination, if what we know is the things that aren't working? How do we imagine something that could work?
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Lydia Parr, an essayist and author of the new book, The Exit is the Entrance, Essays on Escape. Lydia, thank you very much for coming on and talking about this.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the series.
Today, a lot of people are entering a more flexible and potentially problematic workforce, gig work. From Uber to DoorDash to TaskRabbit and all other kinds of jobs, app-based work has taken off over the past several years and has brought both opportunities and concerns. Alexandria Ravenel is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her most recent book is called Side Hustle Safety Net: How Vulnerable Workers Survive Precarious Times. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with how Ravenel defines the gig economy.
So the gig economy is informal work, but it's informal work that is app enabled. So informal work can include things like babysitting or mowing the lawn for neighbors or pet sitting and getting paid in cash. But we have the gig economy when that is going through an app, when it's technologically enabled, and when the app is taking a cut of your earnings.
And for how long have we had this gig economy sort of as we know it now?
So the gig economy as we know it really starts after the Great Recession. So with the Great Recession, we have people needing to do more with less because of the high unemployment rate. We also see that smartphones become essentially universal in the US. And we have the technology that makes it possible for people to post reviews, to post ads from various places. And so all those things come together to give us the gig economy.
Well, so how would you describe the evolution of the gig economy from that time to where we are now in 2024?
So in the early gig economy, the focus is all on, you know, making do with less, people turning to these free sites or low cost sites. And it's all about sort of we're in this together, if I can steal a COVID phrase. But then people start looking at the gig economy as a way to supplement their salaries or a way to earn money. And that's where we start to see the explosion of things like Uber and Lyft, Airbnb, TaskRabbit. We see this growth of people turning to gig work because they're not making enough money at their job, or because they can't get a sufficient number of hours, or because the cost of living has simply gone up and their paycheck hasn't kept up. And so that is where we find ourselves today, with this thriving gig economy of people turning to it as a way to make ends meet and to support themselves.
I'm curious about that, because I wonder if there's a sense of how many people who are involved in the gig economy are doing it as sort of a side hustle, as a way to supplement the income of their quote-unquote day job, and how many people are just doing gig work. They're maybe, you know, driving Uber and working for DoorDash and TaskRabbit and Instacart and some of those others.
Yeah. So in my first book, Hustle and Gig, which came out in 2019, I divide these workers into three groups. They're the strugglers, the strivers, and the success stories. And the strivers are sort of the average person who's just turning to gig work as a way to supplement. And then we have the strugglers, and these are the people who have turned to the gig economy as an occupation of last resort. These are the individuals who are part of the long-term unemployed, who have run out of unemployment assistance, who maybe have been job hunting, but they're not finding anything. And then at the opposite end of that, we have the success stories. And these are the people who are making a career of this, but they're living the life that everyone wants. And in terms of percentages, the majority of people doing gig work probably fall into that striver. But then we have a significant portion, maybe about 10 to 15, maybe 20%, who are strugglers. And then we have probably about 10 to maybe 15% that are going to be the success stories.
Hmm. So in terms of the amount of money that a gig worker can earn, does it depend on how often they are able to do it, and maybe which platform and which service they are providing?
Oh, absolutely. So my two books have focused on sort of lower wage gig workers, but I've actually been interviewing what I call elite gig workers also. And these are people who have $1,000 a day minimum wage. Now, that is not your average Uber driver.
Yeah.
That's going to be individuals who are on websites that focus on marketing plans or strategic plans for corporations. For most gig workers who aren't on these elite platforms, once you factor in how much time they're actually spending logged in on these platforms and the cost of their expenses like cars and gasoline, they're probably making around minimum wage and in some places less.
And in terms of the debate about whether, you know, gig workers should be considered contractors or employees, and, you know, the dangers, I guess, that are inherent, you know, for example, if you're letting a stranger into your car or something, what have you heard from people who are doing these jobs as far as what they think about doing them, and, you know, whether they feel like it's a good way to try to earn money, if they feel exploited, things like that?
Oh, individuals in many cases tell me stories of just crazy experiences. Gig workers are exposed to an exceptional level of risk while they are working. There is the risk of sexual harassment or sexually uncomfortable experiences. There's the risk of getting injured on the job and they don't qualify for workers' comp because they are 1099 or gig workers. There's even the risk of getting involved in criminally questionable behavior. I've interviewed drivers who thought that they were being used as drug mules driving around drug dealers.
Wow.
I've interviewed people who have been hired for tasks that they later figured out were probably scams. You know, this work is incredibly risky. And in many cases, the workers do experience a sense of exploitation or a feeling as though the work that they're doing is stigmatized.
So when you look out, let's say 3, 4, 5, 10 years from now, what do you think the gig economy is going to look like?
Unfortunately, I think it is going to continue to grow, and I think it's going to continue to expand. So I've been interviewing workers in the gig economy for about 10 years. I've interviewed hundreds of workers, thousands of hours of interviews. And one of the really surprising and concerning trends that I'm seeing is the rise of what I call shadow gig platforms. And these are gig platforms that most people have never heard of, and they focus on B2B work. And so what ends up happening is you have a company that previously had W-2 workers and starts to hire 1099 workers to do the same work, and eventually works on sort of replacing the majority of their W-2 workforce with these 1099 workers. And we're starting to see it across a variety of industries, everything from nursing and delivery work to warehouse work to restaurant work.
That sounds like it could potentially be a pretty significant shift in the American labor market.
It absolutely could. Our labor force is built on the premise that we have W-2 work. You know, that's how we structure everything from workplace protections. That's how we structure workers' comp. That's how we structure even some of the new policies that have been passed in certain states regarding family leave or paid sick leave. If workers aren't classified as W-2 workers, but they're classified as 1099 instead, then all of those recent hard-won protections and progressive moves, they really don't do very much.
All right. Well, Alexandria, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Alexandria Ravenel is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her latest book is called Side Hustle Safety Net: How Vulnerable Workers Survive Precarious Times.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. ASU President Michael Crow has been named to the Time 100 climate list of the 100 most influential climate leaders of the year. He's the only university president on the list and one of only three people associated with higher education to make the cut. What role do colleges and universities play in trying to mitigate the impacts of climate change? Could higher education have an impact both inside and outside of the classroom? My co-host Mark Brody talked about this with Haley Campbell, an ASU alum who's now co-executive director of Care About Climate and an organizer for the National Youth Climate Conference. And they started with what she thinks the role of higher ed is when it comes to dealing with climate change.
Yeah, universities play a really significant role when it comes to managing and responding to, but also leaning on tackling climate change, because they not only have an opportunity to shape and research and policies and students that are really going to be taking on these leadership roles that have to really deal with this crisis in the future, but they're also a small model of what it's like to be in a community that has the potential to really be acting and showing up by example as what it means to live a climate resilient lifestyle. So they really play an important role on transforming what future leaders will be thinking, but also transforming how the communities that they're in are seeing and acting in a climate resilient way.
So how much of that to you comes in the classroom, and how much of that happens outside the classroom?
That's a really amazing question. As someone who actually chose my university based solely on the fact they offered one of the oldest and first ever degrees in sustainability, for me, it was outside the classroom that inspired me to start my degree, and inside the classroom where I was able to further my interest area for their learning about climate change and the intersections of all the different social justice issues, and really find my career, not just a passion because I love, you know, problem solving, but really something that's a call to action. But then outside the classroom is really where you're able to do most of that hands-on learning, to really see how taking charge on climate change can actually work. And so I think it's a combination of getting students excited in the classroom to work on climate for those that never saw themselves playing a role in that field, but then also the opportunity to experience what it's like to work on that outside the classroom and put their critical thinking and system thinking skills to the test to create a better future that we all want to live in.
It's interesting how you described a university as kind of like a miniature city, almost like a test case for how maybe larger entities, larger places can try to deal with some of these issues. What kinds of maybe ideas spreading from universities to their surrounding communities or to other places have you seen in terms of the kinds of things that a university might try to do to deal with climate change?
Yeah, there are quite a lot of opportunities at various universities to actually work on real life projects. For example, a lot of universities that are kind of bigger in larger cities tend to have, you know, research centers or capstone projects that work with their local city and their community to help steward, whether it's climate action plans or sustainability plans or further research to understand how a potential solution might work in the real world. And I think it's really important because they have those resources and also the ambition to say, wow, we really want to figure this out. We're seeing a lot of amplifying disasters that are getting more intense because of climate change. And universities often have some of the newer, more modern technologies or safeguards in place. So they can also be a place for a community to come together in a time of need, but also for a community to come together to learn.
I also wonder about sort of the flip side of that, and if you've seen examples of universities or colleges where they have courses or even maybe degrees about sustainability, climate change, things like that, but maybe their practices aren't really keeping up. Like maybe they're not doing the kinds of things on campus to try to tackle climate change, yet the information is being taught and the research is being done in the classrooms, in the laboratories.
Yeah, it's a really important point. And I really like what you mentioned about students learning in school. Something I was really excited about is my alma mater, Arizona State University, is one of the first institutions to actually require a 3-credit sustainability course for all students as part of general education. So now it's there, it's on the forefront of everyone's minds. But if you look at institutions, not just ASU, but across the nation and even perhaps the world, there's also practices like zero waste living and getting rid of plastics that are part of this fossil fuel industry that's perpetuating the climate crisis that are still existing within schools. And there's also disparities in how schools are adopting these sustainable practices themselves. So I definitely think there's more to be done on kind of walking the talk, as you're kind of mentioning.
So when you look at sort of the overall picture and think about all the various entities that have a role in trying to get a handle on climate change, where do you see universities and higher education relative to any other organization, company, entity that might also have a role here?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, higher education, at least in the United States, is also a business. And so I think from that perspective, the university is as important as an institution as any company, but almost more important because whatever they're not just teaching, but showing in practice, as we discussed earlier, as best practices for living a sustainable life, will stay with anyone who is a professor, a student, a staff member, a partner of these institutions. It really has the potential to transcend the way that we adopt sustainable practices. So I would say, in a sense, they're more important than a lot of companies and other institutions.
All right. And since we are talking about education, I will ask, based on your experiences, your observations, what grade would you give higher education so far in trying to do this?
Wow, that's really interesting. This is a tough question because I think, you know, from one institution to the next, it's really hard to say, you know, we all deserve an A. And I know there's tons of different ranking platforms around the world on this. And so I think higher education, gosh, from what I know of higher education right now, I would say they're probably in that B+ range of growing potential for immense change. But of course, they're still held back by their own level of bureaucracy and politics. And it could be, you know, one university is doing a really good job. It doesn't mean all universities are adopting that. And of course, within their own context of within which they sit, right, universities are also beholden to different rules, right, in the area that they come, or norms even. And so I think that plays a big role. They're not all going to be the same, and they shouldn't. But I'm optimistic that education is going in the right direction. But there is definitely work to do to also make these opportunities more accessible and affordable, at least in the United States context.
That was my co-host Mark Brody speaking with Haley Campbell, co-executive director of Care About Climate and an organizer for the National Youth Climate Conference, about the role of higher ed in the fight against climate change. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. If you've ever seen the Keanu Reeves movie Point Break, you may recall the scene where Reeves' character buys his first surfboard. The salesman is a preternaturally wise adolescent. As Reeves walks out of the shop, the young clerk offers him some vaguely mystical parting advice.
Hope you stick with it. Surfing's the source. It'll change your life. Swear to God.
This idea that surfing is, quote, the source and that it has the power to change your life was likely pulled from the book on which Point Break is loosely based, Tapping the Source by Kem Nunn. Nunn's book is a seminal text in a literary subgenre known as surf noir, hard-boiled stories of criminal desperation that unfold by the sea. When David Olson first read Kem Nunn, it inspired him to do two things: read as much surf noir as he could possibly get his hands on, and start surfing several days a week. These days, Olson is a writer and editor, and he's just released his third curated anthology of surf noir stories, The Amber Waves of Autumn. The collection features authors ranging from literary legends like Joyce Carol Oates to local favorites like Jeffrey Cronenfeld. Olson will be speaking at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe tomorrow evening, and as he told the show's Sam Dingman, editing surf noir is the culmination of a lifelong fascination.
I was born in Southern California, and I grew up going to Oceanside, which is kind of a grittier Southern California beach. At least it was back then. And I just remember finding like hash pipes on the beach and like seeing like these, you know, edgy kind of like guys that were kind of, you know, like surf bums, you know, that everything in life centers around surf, and they'll do whatever they can to scrape together, get their, you know, food and lodging needs met so they can just surf as much as they possibly can. So,
right. That's the prime directive.
Yeah, exactly. I always thought that was kind of a fascinating just sort of way to live life as sort of a beach bum or a surf bum. But, and you know, I think that sort of lifestyle lends itself to some noir themes as well.
Sure.
Depending on what people will do to survive and continue to surf. So
Yeah. What did you find when you actually started surfing? Like, did you connect with it differently as an activity once it became something that you yourself were doing?
Yeah, I didn't start committing crimes to surf, certainly.
That's good.
What I've found personally is that I really connect with just being in the water, in the ocean, in that sort of natural element, with it sort of all around me. And it allows me to sort of reset. My connection to the ocean is almost spiritual in a way. And I've found that if I don't get out at least, you know, 3 days a week, I start to feel off, you know? So,
yeah. Could I ask you to say more about that? Do you have language for what that feeling of reset is that the ocean gives you? Is it concrete in any way, or is it more just a feeling?
Yeah. I mean, can you find the words for it? No, yeah. But I can write about it probably for, for years to come.
Right.
And never quite find it. But, in some areas, especially very popular surf breaks, there can be a lot of people crowded around one like good wave, like that's breaking in a certain specific place.
Right.
And so you'll get, you know, 20 and 30 guys out there, and you know, and it's sort of inevitable that not everyone's, you know, obeying the same unwritten rules, which is a whole nother sort of topic that we can talk about, the rules of surfing. I prefer not to be in heavy lineups. I'm looking really for that inner peace, that connection with nature.
It's interesting to me that you brought up this idea of the unwritten rules of this world, because I think of noir stories as people who, you know, they're usually about people who break the rules in the most basic definition of it.
They break laws, like, you know,
yeah,
big social contract laws, but they usually have very specific sets of rules that yes. they'll follow that, right. that make sense to them, right?
Right. And oftentimes the main characters in noir stories, whether it's surfing or otherwise, are people who understand both sets of rules, the yeah. official ones and the not so official ones.
Totally.
What are some of the unwritten rules of surfing?
I mean, when you're starting out, if you're obviously new and kind of floundering around out there, they call you a kook. And this is one part of surfing that I generally don't like, is that people who think that they're like the best surfer out there, or this is like their local break. This is a very territorial sport, which is funny too. They think that they can just take every wave, right?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. So there's certain guys out there like, I am who I am. You should know who I am. Don't get near me when I'm paddling into a wave, or right. I'll run you over. Right.
Right. Like, right.
And then there's like the actual rules, which are, you know, if you paddle out, there's a rotation and the guys, there's a certain point at which is probably the best spot to take off on a wave. And people sort of paddle into that spot in sort of a line, you know, a lineup. And so you take turns getting into position. So, you know, a kook might just kind of like paddle right past a few guys mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. Or there's the dreaded drop in. So for those that don't know what a drop in is, if somebody is standing up on a wave surfing and you're down the wave a bit and you catch the wave and stand up and sort of block them from moving the direction they're going on the wave, it's called a drop in. So anyway, those are, don't drop in, you know, respect the rotation and, whoever the surf god is at the time, you have to respect them.
Right. These all, I have to say, you know, obviously it's somewhat tinged by the nature of the collection of stories we're talking about, but you could imagine those rules, if you take the surfing context away, just in the words, they would map very neatly onto, say, like a criminal organization.
Totally, right? And I can't remember the name of the beach. There's a beach in Southern California. I think it's Rancho Palos Verdes or something like that, where there was like a surf gang.
In real life, there was.
In real life, it's this group of surfers that live there, and they would slash tires and like jump people for that they didn't know for trying to surf there.
Wow.
And I just remember reading this article recently, like, so the city finally decided to do something about it. And I was like, oh, interesting. Well, you know, do they hire law enforcement? What do they do? And it was like, oh yeah, they put some signs up that said, you know, be respectful of everybody out here or something. Like, I was just thinking,
wow,
they solved it. And that was it. And they're definitely not going to have any more trouble.
what an appropriately chill.
A couple of signs are definitely going to deter these people.
That's fascinating. So is this a world that you write in yourself?
Yeah. I've been working on a novel for the past 2 years about a female big wave surfer whose mom was killed 8 years ago. And then a sort of a body washes ashore. Takes place here in Pebble Beach. There's a famous surf break here in Pebble Beach that breaks at 40, 50, 60, 70 feet wow. called Ghost Tree. And I developed this character sort of around some of the actual people that I've met that have surfed the wave. They used to surf it a lot until there was a local legend that drowned out there. His name was Peter Davy, but it's about a mother-daughter duo that surfed that big wave, and then the mom sort of goes missing.
Yeah. Over the course of our conversation, you have referenced a couple of times this idea of the danger inherent in surfing. So much noir storytelling, I find, is about our desire to find safe ways of leaning into our curiosity about death and depravity and what it would be like to live in the underworld and if we could survive it.
Right.
The ocean is such a concrete representation of the promise and the peril of being alive.
Totally. I mean, I would be lying if I didn't think about my mortality every time I went out.
Mm.
And specifically here on the Monterey Bay, we're on the Red Triangle, which is the primary migratory path of the great white shark. So I've had close friends, you know, attacked by them. And so that's, you know, it's always something that you think about.
But if I'm hearing you right, for you at least, it's worth that spiritual reset that it can deliver.
It is. And, you know, I use it as a time of meditation and, you know, I like breath focus. So I'm out there, I'm just focusing on the breath, and then I'm focusing on being present and just feeling the water on my skin, and it's, it resets me in a very special way.
Wow. Well, David Olson is the editor of The Amber Waves of Autumn, which is the third in his collection of anthologies of surf noir. David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning. We'll have much more as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you will find our monthly playlist. They're pretty good. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.